Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, and returning this time is Jelani Sims.
Hello, nice to be with you again.
Now, you were on for the Huckleberry Finn episode, and
yes.
That was a book I chose and pestered you to read. So this time, inviting you back, I asked you what book you would like to read, and you came up with an interesting one.
I did. It's called Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank, and it's about what happens if the Russians attack America with nuclear bombs.
This is the first time for me reading this book. Growing up, I saw this book everywhere in used bookstores. It was when I was a kid, this book got put into the science fiction section of bookstores, and I think that's a funny way to categorize it, because it's not really science fiction-y, except that it takes as its premise that North America has been destroyed by a nuclear war, but it doesn't really move in any of the kinds of ways you might think of a science fiction novel to move.
So what would you classify it as?
I don't know. I mean, this book came out a few years after Neville Shute's famous novel On the Beach. Now that's probably the most famous literary nuclear Armageddon, except for, we were talking before, the Road, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which came out just recently. This is what people who are big science fiction fans are always saying, is that on the one hand, people relegate genre to science fiction. They think that, oh, science fiction, people view science fiction as somehow less than. And so when people take on serious subjects, somehow it's not science fiction. On the other hand, I think a lot of science fiction readers and writers get frustrated when they think that literary writers take on science fiction tropes and they get to, you know, Margaret Atwood resisted the idea of that The Handmaid's Tale was science fiction.
Well, people get real confused. They don't know whether to call it literary now, or is it genre, or what is it going to be? It's too sophisticated and deals with too many themes to just be drivel for the public, for the plebeians. So,
but in any case, you did read this book. So tell me about your history with this book.
Well, I first encountered the book in high school. It was on one of the reading lists, and we had to read it. And of course, I approached it skeptically. Another book I'm being forced to read, being hounded to read. But the thing I remember about my first interaction was that it actually swept me away. This was one of those books that was on the list and you didn't expect it, but it was really good. I had thought that it was thrilling back then. And it sat on my bookshelf in the years after I read it in high school. And I'd always wanted to revisit it because I remembered enjoying it and I wanted to get back to it again. And then, of course, when you approached me to do the podcast, I came up with this book, especially considering some of the current events that are going on that have to do with nuclear warfare and nuclear anxiety. And I thought it'd be a good choice.
It was written in 1960 by Pat
1959,
Frank.
I believe.
Oh, right. Written in 1959. It takes place kind of in 19... did they ever get the date? I think it takes place in like 1960 or something like that.
But it might be that, yeah. I can't remember any specific dates mentioned right off the top of my head.
So this is a time when America is just really getting underway with the Cold War with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
With the Soviet Union has just demonstrated that it has nuclear weapons a few years earlier than this. And so this is that weird sliver of time when the threat of nuclear war is out there, but the main threat comes from deployment by bombers. So America still feels like it's got a little bit more leeway than Europe or Moscow has, because we're protected by oceans. This is a little bit before ICBMs. So it's an odd time, and part of the weird thing about this book is the expectation that you would have several days' notice before a war broke out.
Mm-hmm.
So that marks it as kind of a different book.
Well, what's also interesting about this book is that you mentioned the water. These missiles in the story actually launched from submarines.
Right.
Yeah. So they didn't have much notice. It kind of, as it spoils out in the book, it kind of just all of a sudden it happens. And they're like, so soon, man, we have any time to prepare for this at all.
Yeah. So I'm going to give a summary of this book. It doesn't really have a ton of plot, but it is a book that has a lot of characters, like really characters. If you grew up reading genre fiction from the 50s and 60s, you'll recognize some of these characters, and we'll talk about that in a bit here. So this takes place in the fictional city of Fort Repose, Florida, and it follows the adventures of Randy Bragg, who is a failed politician and a bird watcher. He is alerted of imminent nuclear war by his brother Mark, who's a colonel in the Air Force. Armed with a few days' warning, he stocks up on provisions and welcomes into his home Mark's wife Helen and his nephew and niece, as well as his own girlfriend Elizabeth. After a nuclear attack wipes out most of North America, including nearby Orlando, where all the electricity is made for the city, Randy and his houseguests, along with his neighbor Malachi and Malachi's family, and the town doctor Dan Gunn, form a sort of a bastion of civilization, rallying the survivors of Fort Repose as best they can, laying pipes for an artisanal well, and developing a barter system to distribute resources. They deal with irradiated jewelry, looting drug addicts, and learning to forage, fish, and salt their own food. When Dan is beaten and robbed by bandits, Randy establishes a sort of a martial law, capturing and hanging the criminals in an operation that unfortunately claims Malachi's life. In spite of everything, the apocalypse turns out pretty good for Randy, who gets into shape, stops drinking, and becomes the de facto leader of the survivors. Eventually, troops from what remains of the U.S. military show up and let everyone know that Denver is now capital of the United States and that we won the war. One thing I wanted to say about this that struck me right away is this really is Randy's story all the way through. This is like the story of a guy who, when the book starts, is down on his luck, drinks too much, doesn't really have any direction, and he rises to the occasion of this extreme catastrophe.
Well, you're definitely counting him out at the beginning because he's introduced through the eyes of another character named Florence. And she introduces him as a womanizer, a peeping Tom, a dirty, disheveled, living off of old money and his old family clout in this little community. So at the beginning of the book, you kind of look at him as a speck of dust, and it's kind of a surprise that he ends up rising up and becoming kind of the leader of the community.
He isn't even the first character introduced, and as you say, when we first are introduced to him, we're told that he's a peeping Tom. It turns out later that he claims he was bird watching.
Yeah.
You can believe him or not, I guess. Given the warning from his brother, again, it's not exactly clear to me how his brother knows that this time nuclear war is about to start. But his brother in the Air Force knows that tensions have gotten bad and that.
He and his brother are kind of put forth as these, you know, amazing military minds that can kind of predict and understand what's going on and really have a grasp beyond what, you know, the surface that other people see.
Yeah, I think that's a key to the way that characters are written in this book. This is one thing that I do think makes it feel a lot like science fiction from the 50s and 60s to me is it's about exceptional people who are very good. First of all, they're very competent at everything. Like they can immediately just figure out how to lay pipes for an artisanal well. We're told that they can lay these pipes after 3 hours of work. And I've had to fix a leaky bathtub and it's taken me longer than 3 hours, but somehow he's able to do this. He's able to figure out how to salt meat. They're able to figure out how to distill liquor, which is a dangerous thing. It's a very
it's like they were doomsday preppers, like before this happened at all.
Yeah, exactly. And we're told that they can do all these things partly because they're just such good judges of character. They're constantly sitting around, you know, armchair generaling what happened with the war, and they're talking about, they just kind of know everything, and we're supposed to just take it as read that they're correct in all their assessments about everything.
Yeah, I think, and that's definitely the way they present it. And you actually kind of enlightened me to that, because, you know, as I read it, I just accepted it that, you know, yeah, if this happened, they would know what to do with it. And I think that it's kind of that vicarious experience as well with any novel. If this happened to me through these characters, I know I'd be able to handle it. I'd be able to, you know, survive a nuclear explosion, figure out how to get food for myself, you know, make my way in this new world. And I think that, you know, a lot of people want to feel that way, or did want to feel that way, especially back then when they felt that nuclear war was such a threat. They wanted to make sure that they could survive after that.
Randy is held up in contrast to people who aren't able to make a go at it in this new world. And one of the first persons to die in this book is the head of the bank.
Yeah, Edgar Quisenberry.
Yeah, who commits suicide, not because he is in mourning for all the people who have died or he's lost someone dear to him. He's committing suicide because he can't stand to live in a world without currency.
He completely loses his purpose. His life is tied up in the bank. And once there's no more money, once there's no more bank, there's no more him.
I just don't buy that, though. I mean, I can understand that he feels you would feel this blow to your personal identity, but he's particularly upset about the whole idea that there's not going to be a dollar, and he doesn't like the idea of living in a world without some sort of a centralized economy. And to me, that's sort of like, yeah, that's a problem, but that's not the immediate problem to deal with in the right after the bombs have dropped.
But you have to think about the fact that that was his area of control. Yeah. And when something like this happens, you lose control of everything that you had before, your life, your basic, your routine, all of that goes out the window. And I think it's addressed later on in the book that characters mention that some people can handle that loss of control, that loss of meaning and purpose, and kind of repurpose themselves for this new world. And some can't, and he represented the person that couldn't make that jump. And I found that moment in the story actually pretty compelling myself, and I can see how someone could get to that point if their purpose is so tied into work and so tied into civilization that, you know, they just self-destruct once civilization falls away.
It's not that I don't think that it couldn't happen. This was one of the first big novels about nuclear war, and so it had to do a lot of work just imagining all the things that go wrong when all of the infrastructure is destroyed. And that's the sort of thing that is so monumental. It is difficult sometimes to get your head around. I think for generally, they do a good job. Frank does a good job in this book of imagining the problems that would come up and being clear-eyed about what the issues are. But sometimes I felt like his priorities were a little weird, and the things that he focused on seemed a little weird. I think that, you know, for example, we've read enough nuclear fiction since then, or seen enough movies about this, that I think he just doesn't give enough credit for the simple shock of the people living with the monumentality of what's happened. There's the people kind of, when the bombs are going off, they say, oh, that was this city or that city. And when Orlando finally goes, they go, oh, that was Orlando. And they know it was Orlando because they lose their power. And that seems to be the big concern for them, is now they have no power, rather than how many million people just died, or who, you know, or specifically my uncle who lives in Orlando is now dead. That kind of thinking. There's more of this. Everyone is able to abstract themselves from the horror of what happens very quickly, I feel, in this book.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of PTSD going on, is there? And he does seem to do a lot of protecting of these characters as well, as far as something like, say, the radioactivity. I felt that maybe that would have touched them and it wouldn't have been a trick of the wind to save them, especially with all the major cities around them being nuked. They definitely would have encountered some more radiation than they did. They're kind of in this bubble, almost this protective bubble, this fantasy land of survival, when in reality it may have definitely been a lot more bleak for them.
Yeah, there's a plot point about halfway through the book where a guy named Porky has gone through the ruins of Miami and looted a bunch of jewelry and brought it into town, and that introduces irradiated objects into town, and people start having problems with that, and it kills Porky off. The problem with that whole sequence is, first of all, it happens very quickly, and it's to the point, you know, it takes maybe 2 or 3 pages of the story for them to find out what's happening, and they have to deal with the aftermath and of what to do with Porky's body and with all this irradiated jewelry. But at one point, a woman, a character, has one of these rings, and they say, "Oh, they could see a stain on her finger, which was radium poisoning."
Yeah.
And that bothered me very much, because radium is not irradiated metal. Radium is its own element. And so whatever she's got in her hand right now, it isn't radium. And that sort of thing pops me out of the moment and makes me question whether or not it makes me question the extreme authority everyone in this story is supposed to be talking with. When the head of the bank shoots himself, we're told the bullets were so old they had mold on them. And I'm like, bullets don't get moldy? I mean, maybe they would turn, if they were copper, they would turn green from oxidizing, is what I guess he meant. But there's these moments where I feel like Pat Frank doesn't have a handle on what's actually happening. And I feel like when I notice those things as a reader, I feel, what did I miss because I don't have the expertise? And then I start questioning a lot of things. We're supposed to buy that there's this clear zone that these people are in that has been untouched by radiation. So all of the problems they have to deal with are simply where they get the food from and how they divide up their resources.
Well, I think the genre that we could put this in, now that I'm thinking about it, is speculative fiction. And I think that this is the issue that you run into with speculative fiction, because we're supposed to be speculating how something could happen in the real world, but we're still in the fantastical. So I think that that's, I think the moldy bullets, the fact that they don't, the fact that the radiation doesn't touch them, the whole, in fact, that part of the story where he gets the jewelry, the kind of the moral fable tinge to it, even the fact that this is something that he stole, and he was focused on material things, and all these material things are affected with radioactivity. And the lesson is you shouldn't have vanity, especially kind of in this, you know, apocalyptic world. I think that tension is definitely going on. And I can agree with you that sometimes Frank can't balance it, really.
I think that this book reminds me a lot of men's magazines after the war. Yeah. You know, if you ever see like Men's Life, there's that famous cover from an issue of Men's Life that as the guy being attacked by all the weasels. that became the name of the Frank Zappa.
Or they're
album.
Like in the jungle, and right. They like got snakes. You know, that's kind of right. Where Tarzan came from, and all
exactly
that.
all these, and they're all fighting Nazis still, even though the war's over. And the reason I feel that is, Randy's story is the story of becoming a real man. You know, it's sort of like in this new brave new world when all the artificial bits of society go away. Now it's time to reassert vigorous manhood. Yeah. And that means being competent. That means being brutal if you need to. You know, he makes an example of these robbers because he needs to uphold the order of the society.
In this archaic way, we might add, which is very interesting.
Right. Well, he hangs them, which is...
Yes.
It's just not a, you know... We probably should also mention here, this is taking place in 1960. This is and Malachi, I did not mention in my summary, Malachi is African American.
Yes, and his whole family. And what is the Missouri is another character.
Right.
And then there's some children. There's one or two kids. Yeah.
Right. So race in this book
is a problem.
It is a big problem. It is not dealt with well.
I was trying to thumb through the book and find the offending passages, but I do remember some of the things he said. Like, I think they were in the dark at one time and either Malachi or somebody else in their family was smiling. And he said, we could see the whites of their eyes and their teeth and, you know, calling them Negroes and making a big deal of the kids being educated together in the same room. Oh, now we have integrated education here. Also, these moments of trying to be very progressive and kind of pointing out that this nuclear bomb would kind of equalize everybody. And, you know, Randy is working with the Malachis, and it's the Malachis who have the idea about the artisan water, who, you know, are a big point in their survival. And Malachi is even lifted up as a martyr at the end, like you said, during the battle with the highwaymen when he is a casualty. But still with the racist imagery and just the way that black people are handled, you can tell that Pat Frank is unfortunately a typical white man in the 50s and is just completely through that lens.
Yeah, it is. And I like what you say, that you get the feeling that Frank thought he was doing something progressive here, because the idea is that after the bomb falls in this new utopia that Randy is setting up, Malachi gets to just be another guy in this group, and that somehow they're going to be race blind. But that's not really the case. And when Malachi offers at the end of the book, when they are laying a trap for these bandits, Malachi offers to play the role of bait, basically. He's going to be the driver of this vehicle that's going to get robbed. And he says he'll do it because they will look at him as a black man and think that he's an easier target. And it's such a weird and gross moment, because on the one hand, Frank is saying, oh, Malachi is playing to the prejudices of the bandits, who are bad people in part because of their racial imagination.
Yeah.
But it's also buying into it. And it's also Malachi, he is presented as a martyr. He is presented as a hero. But it's sort of like Frank is trying to say, oh, even the black character can be good, you know, and you just feel really gross reading it.
Well, it's kind of an oxymoron, actually, because all of a sudden, you know, they care about race enough to where he needs to be riding in the front seat. I thought all of that had fallen away. So,
right.
So it's like we can't get out of that trapping. I think that's a matter of author's lens, that apparently he's just the typical prejudiced man in the 50s, and he can't really write a character who really just has no way of knowing anything about, really thinking about the lengths that people went through to keep black people and white people separate. Of course, you'd only have stereotypes to then write about somebody, because that person is, that figure is kept away from you so much.
Beyond race, which is the worst part of this book, there's also gender issues.
Mm-hmm.
Randy has around him this community of people, including his girlfriend Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is there mostly as a trophy. In fact, at one point, he calls her a beautiful possession, and he talks about wanting to marry her, which I find really quaint, because obviously they're living together after this nuclear Armageddon, but still they want to have the legitimacy of a civil marriage around their union.
Mm-hmm.
But she's held up as a model of the kind of woman who would survive after this war, but mostly because she's so agreeable. She makes their house full of comfort. You know, she's able to find coffee for them. That's a big deal. The coffee has been missing,
I remember that scene.
Yeah, the book holds her up like some sort of a major treasure, but she's never really given any chance to do anything. You know, Peyton, the daughter, who's the niece, the daughter of his brother, does more for the community by finding a bunch of old technology up in the attic that is not electrically driven, like a sewing machine that is pump driven or a phonograph that's a Victrola that's crank driven.
I find it interesting that you mentioned the woman's role, because I also think about Florence, and she's also presented as somebody that would survive this apocalypse. And I think that I don't remember what character refers to her that way, but she's referred to as a guppy, a fish that could just, you know, handle anything that comes at it, whatever hardships. But there again, she's not the pretty type of woman. She's kind of the frumpy woman over here, the gossip, she's the Western Union worker. So that's kind of the other picture of a woman that you have in this apocalypse. So either kind of the frumpy woman, the librarian, the Western Union worker, or Liz.
There's another interesting character here who doesn't show up that much, but there's a retired admiral named Admiral Hazard.
Yes, I really liked his character.
Yeah, he's a fun character because he gets to be sort of the elder statesman who sits and talks about the world. That he gets to be the philosophical voice of the book.
Mm-hmm.
He taps on a copy of Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and talks about how that's explains the whole situation that they're in. And it's kind of hand wavy. I'm not exactly sure why that explains the situation we're in. There are odd similarities between the end of the Pax Romana and the end of the Pax Americana.
Okay, which yeah.
And he says, when it became common to spend $1 million to elect senators from moderately populous states, I think that should have been a warning to us. For instance, free pap for the masses. Now, he's making a claim here that somehow something has been lost in a society where our government has become so monetized, or where it provides services to people. I don't know how we make the leap between that and nuclear war.
Yeah.
But it's funny that as a crusty old military guy, he's complaining about big government, and he's complaining basically about a welfare economy or welfare state. So I guess not much has changed since the 60s as far as that goes.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't at all. But it's interesting that you mentioned that, because there seem to be a lot of other themes that are kind of leading us to nuclear war, as far as, you know, pursuit of too much knowledge, going so far that we end up rewinding ourselves back. I don't know where I was going with that. You'll have to edit that out. But I was thinking about, speaking of theories that he quotes, he does also quote another, he references something. It was on page 133 of my book. It said, you remember what Toynbee says. His theory of challenge and response applies not only to nations, but to individuals. And so I looked it up, and he's referring to Arnold J. Toynbee, and he has an article called Challenge and Response that's about civilizations and their survival. And in the article, he uses the image of the first humans crossing the Bering Strait. And as they moved into colder climates, some people turned back and remained savages. Some remained out in the wilderness, but were not able to innovate and so died. And then finally, there were those who figured out how to build fire, how to build huts, how to move forward in the wilderness and find food and make it to, you know, the other side of the world, to what we now call North America. And so I found it interesting reading that and then tying it back into the book, the different types of reactions to survival. You have, you know, Edgar Quisenberry, who doesn't want to go forth into this new world. He'd rather remain a savage or remain in the old world with his money, and he kills himself. And then you have those who, of course, not really on screen, because everybody on screen is pretty good at surviving, but those off screen who surely perished because they didn't know what to do in this new nuclear world. And then you have Randy and his group of people who have figured out how to build fire, so to speak, after this nuclear holocaust, and figure out what to do.
I like that quote also because it ties back to what we were discussing earlier about the personalities that flourish in this book are the ones who speak with expertise and knowledge and competence. And mm-hmm. there's such a positive attitude towards psychology, towards theories of sociology. It's weird that in a way, right after everything has been completely blown up, the main characters here are arguing political, philosophical points as though, you know, humanity hasn't just failed. Mm-hmm. It's like there's been this major failure of civilization, and yet all the main characters in the book are going to sit around and they're going to quote Edward Gibbon, they're going to quote Toynbee, they're going to sit around and they're going to make these proclamations. And I think as readers, we're supposed to go along with it. We're supposed to admire them for this. There's a kind of dialogue that happens in this book that you couldn't write in a modern novel. I don't think people would write modern novels about people having these kinds of discussions. Or if they did have those discussions, the people would be coded very much as nerds or outsiders.
Well, on the flip side of that, I would say that these conversations symbolize man's desire to continue on with kind of the status quo and what he'd had from before, because, you know, they're talking about civilization and coming together and restoring what they had or maintaining what they had. And so I think that those conversations could be looked at almost as a hope, kind of holding on to some of the civility and some of what we used to have.
You know, we were talking also before we started recording about other works of post-apocalyptic mm-hmm. fiction, and right around the same time was the novel A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller. And that is a book about the preservation of knowledge through the new dark ages after. So it compares what happens after a nuclear apocalypse to the Middle Ages. So it also is taking classical track. If you buy into the idea that Western civilization was going great until the fall of Rome, and then we had these dark ages, and the only thing that kept us going were these monasteries that were preserving the great works of classical literature and the great works of Islamic mathematics, and then until the Renaissance came. And the A Canticle for Leibowitz also takes this story where after the nuclear war, all of mankind's knowledge is being preserved by monks who are writing about it. They don't understand it. They don't understand anything that they're writing down, but they're writing it. But that's a much more cynical book in a way, because it ends up being cyclical, that what happens is you preserve this knowledge and we just keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, and in that book, it has a lot of Christian imagery, since the main characters are monks preserving knowledge. And so the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is mentioned. And, you know, this idea that all the knowledge that we've received it ends up being a detriment to us. And you have also stories like Pandora's Box, where, you know, once you've opened it up, once you've received knowledge of everything, there comes the trouble. And I think the nuclear bomb definitely is a Pandora's Box, kind of a fruit on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, just because of the amount of damage that we could do to each other with that kind of capability. And the fact that we figured out how to split atoms and fuse them together, I don't even know how we figured out how to do all of that.
In some ways, it's a very small story. It's a story told on a very small scale. There are cutaways there early on in the book where we get to see what's going on at Air Force Command and what's happening with some fighter jets or some bombers that are being deployed. We lose that very quickly, and we lose that omniscient view very quickly, and it just becomes about these people living in Florida.
Yeah, he cuts us off from the real world completely, because you remember the only hints they have from the outside world are General Hazard's radio and whatever, you know, messengers may come through town or whatever they might get from traveling around the area.
I was joking when we started that when I was a kid, every story I read seemed to start with there'd been a nuclear war and now this is what happens afterwards. That that became such a cliche of science fiction that it was usually dealt with in the first minute or two of a story, and then you're on to the next thing. You're sort of like, okay, now we deal with the post-apocalyptic world, because nobody's really that concerned about how you got there.
Yeah.
So it's funny to read this book that only deals with nuclear war, and deals with the practicalities of things. Although I got the feeling by the end of the book that he was really running out of things to say or out of steam, because there was the penultimate chapter of the book deals with a time when they don't have a lot of food and it's too hot, so none of the fish are biting, and they've run out of salt to salt the meat.
Then a deus ex machina, of course.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's solved by he finds an old memoir of the guy who founded the town saying, yeah, oh, by the way, there's this hidden place where you can get all the salt you want, you know.
Almost like a fabled fantastical kind of, almost like a oasis in the desert, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, this is Florida. This is like the fountain of youth, you know.
Right. And also there's a salt beach.
So there's this magical salt beach that they're able to go and pick up all the salt, and yeah, now they're going to be okay.
Well, I think there's an issue that you run into with a lot of post-apocalyptic stories. The Walking Dead is completely unrelated, but it has that same issue of what do we exactly do since the world is over and there's no way for them to get out of this? Everybody's going to turn into a zombie when they die. There is no cure. The story just keeps going on and on. You know, when you have a story about nuclear bombs, you've got to go forward thousands of years, kind of like Canticle Leibowitz does, in order to start seeing humanity bouncing back from that. Or, you know, Pat Frank, he makes it to where it's not as, the nuclear bombs aren't as severe. But still yet, what do you do when you're kind of trapped permanently in this new reality that's kind of hopeless? They're going to be without electricity for a while, without, you know, a lot of beneficial electricity for a while. They're going to be without a normal life for a while, maybe the rest of their lives.
It feels so weirdly hopeful at the end of the book. You know, it feels like
he manufactured it completely.
I don't feel any trauma from this. You know, when I was a kid, there was that show that came on. Oh, man. It was like when I was in sixth grade, they did a made-for-TV show called The Day After that it was a huge deal when they ran it on TV because it was going to be this movie.
Wasn't
about
that the highest grossing TV movie of all time?
Yeah, it was huge. It was so huge. And it's so weirdly inoffensive today, but I remember that being fairly traumatic. I've also seen films like, there's a film from the late 80s called Testament, which is kind of the same story. It's about a small town, this time in the Rocky Mountains, that is far enough from any blast areas that people can survive, but where everyone is absolutely doomed. They're just kind of waiting it out until the radiation kills them off. And it's about the people slowly dying from sickness, but trying to maintain dignity at the end of their lives. And that was that I remember watching that movie, and that absolutely destroying me as a kid, that was so sad. And I felt so bad for all the characters. I didn't really feel bad for any of the characters in this book. And I didn't feel bad for the fact that 90% of the U.S. population gets wiped out in this book.
No, it's kind of the Disney version of things. I think you might have to go to, you mentioned Neville Shoots on the Beach. You might have to go there for your bleak tale of waiting for death from radioactivity.
Yes, that's what everyone wants out of one of these post-apocalyptic novels.
Yeah, because in that story, you know, they have the salted bombs, which a nuclear bomb surrounded in cobalt or some sort of other metal. Once it's exploded, it releases radioactivity that has a much longer half-life. So all of that could theoretically travel all around the world and destroy everything.
Yeah, it is a pretty bleak book, On the Beach, and it was made into a movie. And there, my dad has told the story. My dad was Air Force ROTC when he was in college. Mm-hmm. He's told the story that he went to see a showing of On the Beach when it was still in theaters, and he was wearing his ROTC uniform. And he said when he left the theater, everyone was giving him dirty looks because he represented the military as far as they were concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Which is funny because my dad is a pretty pacifistic, he's a pretty staunch liberal. He went on to become a minister and stuff, but I guess he got to feel that heat.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that sentiment, because we're kind of seeing that going on now. There's a lot of anxiety around, you know, political moves that we can't control, especially between, you know, Trump and Kim Jong-un going back and forth and playing with, you know, their knowledge that they have nuclear weapons. You know, the false alarm in Hawaii, all those types of things play into this idea that, you know, we just have no control over what's going on with this. It's just in other people's hands.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that this was kind of a story about survivalists before there were survivalists.
Yeah.
And I do get that feeling that this is a book that would appeal to the kind of person who likes to imagine themselves in crisis, you know, the kind of person who wants to stockpile supplies and weapons because they feel absolutely sure that they are going to have some kind of control when the world comes to an end, you know, whether that be because of nuclear Armageddon, whether that be because the government turns against you or whatever. And whereas I always feel like if things come to that, you're not going to control anything. You're kind of at the mercy of the fates at that point, and you're kidding yourself if you think you have any kind of control over that.
Yeah, you may beg for the fates to take you quickly in that type of situation. Well, I had a passage that I wanted to read.
Great.
This is a, you know, Alice is the librarian. And so this is a depiction of her life after this nuclear bomb, how she goes on as a librarian. Alice reminded herself that this evening she must bring back new books for Ben Franklin and Peyton. It was a surprise and a delight to see children devour books. Without even knowing it, they were receiving an education. Alice would never admit it aloud, but for the first time in her 30 years as librarian of Fort Repose, she felt fulfilled, even important. It had not been easy or remunerative to persist as librarian in Fort Repose. She recalled how every year for 8 years, the town council had turned down her annual request for air conditioning, an expensive frill, they'd said. But without air conditioning, how could a library compete? drugstores, bars, restaurants, movies, the St. John's Country Club in San Marco, the lobby at the Riverside Inn, theaters, and most homes were air conditioned. You couldn't expect people to sit in a hot library during the humid Florida summer, which began in April and didn't end until October, when they could be sitting in an air-conditioned living room, coolly and painlessly absorbing visual pablum on television. Alice had installed a Coke machine and begged old electric fans, but it had been a losing battle. In 30 years, her book budget had been raised 10%, but the cost of books had doubled. Her magazine budget was unchanged, but the cost of magazines had tripled. So while Fort Repose grew in population, book borrowings dwindled. There had been so many new distractions: drive-in theaters, dashing off to springs and beaches over the weekends, the mass hypnosis of the young every evening, and finally the craze for boating and water skiing. Now all this was ended. All entertainment, all amusements, all escape, all information again centered in the library. The fact that the library had no air conditioning made no difference now. There were not enough chairs to accommodate her readers. They sat on the front steps, in the windows, on the floor, with backs against walls or stacks. They read everything, even the classics, and the children came to her when they were free of their chores and she guided them, and there was useful research to do. Randy and Dr. Gunn didn't know it, but as the result of her research, they might eat better thereafter. It was strange, she thought, peddling steadily, that it should require a Holocaust to make her own life worth living. That has a lot. There's a lot of interesting things going in there. The last line where it says a Holocaust for life worth living, that's kind of what we've been talking about, this whole Disney tinge of they're not really seeming to be in pain over a nuclear weapons release. They're kind of finding new meaning really easily. And also, I think that Frank did a good job of showing how education is devalued. I feel it's almost kind of a prediction of things to come, because, you know, education is always the first thing that gets cut funding by the government. And he shows how that knowledge, that thirst for books and that thirst for the collective consciousness comes back once all the other stuff falls away.
On the one hand, it reminds me of people who complain about this new piece of media is taking us away from the authentic piece of media. You know, people right. complain about television makes people not read. That's true to an extent, in so much as people only have so much time, so you only spend so much time doing one thing or the other. But on the other hand, people have been complaining about new media replacing old media forever. You know, people complained about that with novels too, and they complained about that with the written word was going to make us all lose our memories and stuff. But the thing that I find very charming about this is this the idea that now we're going to take away all the technology that is bad and we will be left with the technology that is good, which is reading and writing and books. And that's such an interesting idea, that there was a point, you know, at which we became decadent. We went too far, but up to that point, everything's great. And somehow we can get back to that. You know, it's almost like the Amish idea that we're going to stop technology right here in the 19th century or the 18th century or wherever we're going to stop it. And that's okay, you know.
Well, I think that it also touches on a theme that Canticle to Leibowitz touches on, is that once everything is stripped away, what does humanity have? And that's our ability to record, to gain knowledge, to record, to pass down, to pass on, and to use that collective knowledge in order to build a culture and a society. And so that, I think that is the deep core of it. And so that's why I like the passage, because at the end of the day, that's how we have everything that we have. And that's what we'll have to go back to. That's what we'll have to begin collecting back if we were to go through this type of event.
Well, I like it because it's a passage about books.
Yes.
And that's what this podcast is about.
I actually read it to my students in class, a particular passage, because I have to encourage reading among them, because it's just not something they want to do. And I felt that the teenager that he spoke of in that passage is my students. You know, they're on their cell phones. That is the mass hypnosis that they're going through. And they'd rather take in from the internet and the AI brain than sit down and read a book. And it definitely does show that lack of love for literacy and reading. And so I love the fact that he just drops the promotion of it in the middle of his book. I think every author should do that.
Well, let's hope that it won't take a nuclear war to get people to read again.
Definitely. And you mentioned that scene about the woman in the car. We never...
Oh, yeah. There was one other scene. I found this passage that I mentioned really fascinating because it seemed very like the whole book in miniature to me. It seemed like a lot of the way that Frank likes to write. This is right after the bombs have fallen and Randy is trying to go into town to get some medical attention for the little girl, Peyton, who unfortunately looked at the blast, and he sees a dead woman by the side of the road. And there's a passage that describes the conundrum of whether or not he offers aid. And it goes, "Yesterday, he would have stopped instantly. There would have been no question about it. When there was an accident and someone was hurt, a man stopped. But yesterday was a past period in history, with laws and rules as archaic as ancient Rome's. The rules had changed, just as Roman law gave way to atavistic barbarism, as the empire fell to Hun and Goth. Today, a man saved himself and his family, and to hell with everyone else. Already, millions must be dead, and other millions maimed or doomed by radiation. For if the enemy was hitting Florida, they would hardly skip SAC bases and missile sites in more densely populated areas. Certainly, they would not spare Washington and New York, the command posts and the communication center of the whole nation. And the war was less than a half hour old. So one stranger on the roadside meant nothing, particularly with a blinded child, his blood kin, depended on his mission. With the use of the hydrogen bomb, the Christian era was dead, and with it must die the tradition of the Good Samaritan." Now, after all that, he actually does stop and help the woman, but or try to help the woman. But it's a funny passage because it's so overwritten in a way. It's very florid, and it makes these classical references. I'm always fascinated that the books I read in the 50s keep making references to Rome and Greece and to the Huns and stuff. And I wonder, that just doesn't seem to be part of our collective dialogue anymore. You know, that bespeaks, I think, a time when education was reading Cicero. And it's not that anymore. But there's so much together in that little passage about this sort of the manly, vigorous world that he lives in now, that's a world of action and not a world of ethics, and the idea that we've entered into a world in which these old concerns are gone, and yet it's filled with these old concerns. It's filled with the language of learning and classicism and knowledge. And it's belied in the very next paragraph when he actually does stop and check to see whether the woman is okay. So it's a fun little chapter to me because it feels like this is what Frank is doing as a writer. He's really, in some ways, parts of these books are a bit overwritten, but I love them nonetheless because I love that kind of writing.
Yeah. And actually, the cap that Frank puts on that scene is interesting because you remember when he's on his way back, the woman's van has been looted and all the stuff taken. And right. It's interesting that you called that kind of a microcosm of the story, because you remember towards the end, they had to deal with the highwaymen, which is kind of the ultimate de-evolution of man after this event, back to a savage and a killer. And someone who's going to exploit and survive by any means over others. And I think that Frank wanted to show that Randy is going to somehow maintain that humanity throughout this whole story while others don't. And that's kind of what separates him and makes him a survivor. One of the things it does.
It's a fun book to read. It's it's both longer and shorter than you think it is. I mean, it's
yeah.
it's like a 300-page book, and yet it's all written in this adventure-y prose. So
it clips by pretty quickly.
Yeah, it goes very quick, and it has fun little set pieces. And even the parts of the book that irritate me, I find informative to wrestle with. You know, mm-hmm. I find the part that is probably the worst remains its racial problems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was written also, once again, written during the Cold War, written right before the you know, main show or the main inferno, if you will, of the civil rights movement.
Oh, yeah.
So it is completely grounded in a lot of history that we are repeating right now, unfortunately. I will encourage everybody to pick up a copy of A Last Babylon and read it. Educate yourself on nuclear fission.
Thanks again to my co-host, Jelani Lee. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. If there's a book, play, or poem I haven't covered that you'd like to see covered, why don't you let me know? You can reach me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join in the discussion on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. As always, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.